Hello, good morning, good afternoon, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to another installment of our or in our webinar series. Today we have an extremely exciting topic, and it is organized cybercrime. For a while now, cybercrime has become organized crime, and this trend is only growing. Attacks, are very well orchestrated, targeted, and unfortunately highly successful. And as with most organized crime, we're seeing a convergence here into fraud, beyond what we'd consider the normal cybersecurity crime, ransomware and others driving that. So we're going to dive down into the world of cybercrime. And importantly, we're getting down into this with a true expert. So we're not guessing, we're not making assumptions. This is the view very much from the front line. So I can move my slides on. So let's talk about that expert that we have. So to lead us on this journey, we have Keegan Badenhorst. Keegan is joining us from Redshift, who specialize in threat intelligence and offensive security, and has recently, or Redshift has recently joined the Integrity 360 family. He began his career in penetration testing before moving into cyber intelligence, threat detection, and investigative operations. Today, as the technical lead for cybercrime intelligence, he leads investigations into cybercrime, fraud, and malicious digital activity, focusing on identifying, analyzing, and disrupting threat actors, operations, and criminal infrastructure. So, welcome, Keegan. Great to have you on this webinar today.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Great. And just before I hand over to Keegan to lead us off, I just want to flag a couple of things. Firstly, we will have a Q&A session at the end of this webinar. So please use that Q&A button at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will be, and we are recording this webinar, so you have the ability to watch it back, but obviously also share it with colleagues that have missed it or haven't managed to join today. And very lastly, we have got closed captions available, so use that should you want translation of the webinar in real time. So with that, Keegan, I'm going to stop sharing and hand over to yourself.
Good. So while I was preparing for the webinar, and Rich, I don't know if you know this, but I realized there's actually no universally accepted definition of cybercrime. So this is kind of awkward for us as defenders, because if we don't even have an agreed upon definition, how are we supposed to defend against it? So for the purpose of this webinar, I'm just going to broadly define cybercrime as crimes where technology itself is either targeted or used to commit a crime. So with that in mind, let's just look at how cybercrime actually evolved. So back in the day, in the 80s and 90s, cybercrime was mostly carried out by small ideological groups or just curious individuals, and the attacks were relatively simple. But as technology advanced, cybercriminals actually realized there's a lot of benefits to operating online, such as anonymity, global reach. I mean, it's not very expensive, and there's very little physical risk because it's hard to pinpoint who's actually sitting behind the keyboard. And today, organized cybercrime groups operate much like legitimate businesses, and that is very similar to us. I don't mean we look sketchy, but rather they structure themselves like we would. So this is evident by looking at their leadership. So they're usually led by people with genuine corporate experience who can bring business management principles do their operations and streamline it. And they also have professional infrastructure, just like we have. I mean, they have finance departments, technical teams, operational teams, and even HR. And it usually has their own unique job titles. So, for example, Rich, you being part of the C-suite, you would be considered part of the Council of Elders or Council of Professors, which sounds kind of cool, but the pseudonyms kind of make it hard to map their hierarchies, you
I guess I'm
know?
going to change my job title.
So, one of the best examples I can think of that actually proves how similar they are to us is the fact that they're data-driven. So as more organizations get breached, and sensitive information is often leaked online or on the dark web or clear web, Cybercriminals would then go and get that data and use it to support their highly targeted social engineering campaigns. And this process is really similar to our legitimate sales and marketing operations, you know. So just as businesses would use lead generation platforms like Salesforce, for example, cybercriminals would use lead data sets to identify and target their victims. So, I mean, again, very similar to us. And by using real personal details like ID numbers, phone numbers, full names, it just adds all the more credibility to these scams these days. Because people don't actually realize how much of their personal sensitive information is just publicly available. I mean, I get calls every day asking, how did they get my ID number? I'm like, dude, it's publicly available. Give me 2 minutes, I can get it for you. Just we kind of need to know where to look. And these days, it's no longer just about stealing information, but how the information is actually processed and enriched and operationalized at scale, you know? And this is where AI kind of comes in. It enables them to significantly amplify both the scale and sophistication of their operations. So from a scaling perspective, it kind of allows these groups to kind of rapidly build convincing phishing platforms, fake web applications, or just malicious applications. And this makes it pretty easy to run large scam campaigns across multiple regions without a lot of effort or without it costing too much. And then from a capability perspective, AI is increasing sophistication of attacks. They're using deepfake impersonations, highly personalized scams, and like cross-language communications. So I actually have a couple of examples of deepfake impersonations that we investigated. So the first two, sorry. The first two images here are actually from the same deepfake video. So the video starts with Arabile Komide, who's a news reporter in South Africa, making this wild claim about thousands of South Africans have already opted for early retirement because they made so much money using this AI investment platform. And then he goes on to introduce the former CEO of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, who then tries to convince people to actually invest with this platform. I mean, this is some pretty scary stuff. This deepfake video was based off of an interview she gave in her house. I mean, imagine you're sitting there looking at yourself in your own house, saying words that you've never said. I mean, that's pretty scary stuff.
Yeah, we did piece that one of our Security First conferences of surprising how well I know poetry and Afrikaans, so.
And then the last photo here is of Siya Kolisi, who's the captain of the Springbok rugby team, who, if I might add, continues to beat Britain in the Rugby World Cups. It's just him promoting another investment scam. But this is a common tactic they like to use prominent people to build trust in their scams. So another common tactic would be demonstrating proof of success. So, for example, they would create fake investment dashboards that show growing profits, but in reality, your money is long gone. Or they would allow victims to withdraw small amounts of money early on during the scam, and this encourages them to pay larger sums of money later on. They also like to use social and community validation and proof. So this is where they would use fake reviews or fake testimonials and communities to just build credibility on these scams that they're running. And recently, we've been seeing them requesting KYC documentation. This creates like a weird sense of compliance, but in reality, you're just giving the attackers access to your personal sensitive information. And I mean, this can be used for secondary attacks, identity theft, or to scam someone else using your name. So we've seen people being scammed and they accidentally send them the ID number documents. And then a couple of weeks later, they get asked, why are you stealing my money? And then it's just someone that impersonated them using their ID documents. So to understand the full picture, it's kind of important to look at how they structure their day-to-day operations. So we often see them use customer relationship management system to track victims and manage conversations. So here I actually have an example of a CRM system that we saw organized cybercrime group use. And I know it's a bit blurry, but as you can see, every member in the organization kind of has a target they need to reach, similar to us. Like we have KPIs, they have their targets, salespeople have their quotas. And this was now early in the morning, before they actually started for the day, so everything is at zero. But I mean, this is just shows very similar. And next to it here, we have the internal goal tracking statistics. And again, everybody needs to report to someone. So I mean, keeping track of all these data, this is very similar to us. Then here we have a screenshot of the chat functionality that was baked into the Ethereum system. So these days, it's no longer just some guy with Telegram desktop running on his computer. They actually have very expensive and advanced tooling that they use.
And
So this
I
particular.
think, if I'm correct there, Keegan, this is these screenshots here are things that that you guys uncovered, during an investigation into these platforms.
Yes, correct. So this screenshot here, for example, we actually bypassed the proper channel which they wanted us to go through. So they normally would chat to you via WhatsApp or Telegram, but by analyzing some HTTP responses, we actually saw we can reach this through the Tor network to anonymize ourselves. And this is kind of what they would see on their side.
That's very interesting.
Then from a financial perspective, they usually rely on mule bank accounts, cryptocurrencies, mixes, just to launder the money through multiple layers. So, sorry. I know this is also a bit blurry, but this is a cryptocurrency map. And all of these nodes here are different wallet addresses that we've identified throughout the course of the last couple of months. And all of these were obtained through different scams, an emphasis on the different, Jeff. So different scams, different wallet addresses, all paying into the same wallet address in the end before it's cashed out. And this just shows the level of organizations they're operating at. I mean, then it's a lot. And if you take the monetary value of all of these transactions, it's quite a bit. Then we also see the use of phishing scripts and playbooks. So phishing scripts are usually used to standardize victim interactions, especially for the lower level operators. And these scripts are usually supported by playbooks that define how to interact with your victims, how to manage payments, how to escalate cases, things like that. So here we have two examples of phishing scripts that we have identified throughout the course of our investigations. So again, with the pseudonyms, here, the scammers refer to themselves as teachers and the victims as fans. And then this is a teacher's fan attracting trick. And then here you can see a reply to novice customers. So from a guy who's written a lot of playbooks, it takes a lot of effort. And this just shows how much effort they're actually putting into their operations. So taking all of this into account, it's kind of clear that they've transitioned into well, from like just individuals or small groups to highly organized criminal businesses, you know, and we need to be operating at the same level of organization as they do. Otherwise, we're going to lose this arms race. And right now, it's kind of hard for us because internal departments like fraud, cyber defense, governance, risk, they often operate in silos, and there's very limited information sharing between us. On top of that, people are always concerned about reputational damage, regulatory exposure, and this can further limit how much intelligence we're actually sharing with each other, both internally and externally with law enforcement. So to improve
And
this.
just on that internal bit, are you seeing that there is a bit more of convergence now with those sort of key teams that have been separated? I know you're kind of an advocate of trying to make the trying to drive them together, at least that information sharing.
Yes, exactly. I mean, right now they operate in like very in like in silos, more individually. Like the fraud department won't talk to the cyber risk department about the scams that they're seeing. And we kind of have to, otherwise we don't aim to be able to defend against it. So to improve this, we need coordinated and structured defenses. We need to literally be as organized or more organized as these threat actors are. As I
And
said,
there's a
otherwise
lot
we're
of
gonna lose.
there's a lot of onus there also, sort of out, there's things that are outside of most people's control. I sort of mentioned the external, I suppose there's a collaboration between businesses, but with government departments and I suppose that there is a bit of probably outside of your control, but need to give that influence and to try and get that cross organization, cross function collaboration?
Well, I mean, from our experience, many of the law enforcement departments and regulatory bodies are very open to partnerships. They would love us to share knowledge with them. You know? So, as more banks and more businesses and things like that, we just need to work together to combat this. And then we also need to encourage better incident reporting. So, this goes back to the fear of reputational damage and things like that. We need to encourage this. This is how we're going to be sharing, how this is how we're going to be better sharing intelligence. And then finally, from a shift from reactive to proactive defense is just going to be essential. We need to be identifying attacker tactics, techniques, procedures, the TTPs, so we can better anticipate their behaviors and then build more effective preventative controls. And yeah, Rich, I think that was a quick one from my side. But yeah.
That's brilliant, Keegan. And I think there's some core bits to kind of pull out there. Particular now some of those screenshots that you were showing up there. That and I think it's important to call out. That's the hard work from yourself and the team to effectively infiltrate as part of the activity they're doing to help with the fraud elements, but we're getting that view into the tools that are actually in use and how they're operating. I'm sure there's some plenty some the odd salesperson for our internal teams that's listening into this webinar and can appreciate the drive for entries into the CRM. But it kind of shows that increased targeting that organizations are under with that tracking of the conversations where and actually so we'll talk about individual sorry organizations but even individuals. And I think that's probably another important part that there's we can look at it from how an organization can be targeted, but many times it's using that organization as a conduit to their customers to be able to launch those scams. And even though it's not directly touching an organization, that's obviously affecting brand reputation there as they're being targeted. So that that's I think one of the key takeaways there for me is that persistence, kind of increased targeting that's there, and being able to track all of these in real time, as you say, is we've gone well beyond bedroom hackers into groups, and now we're very very clearly in that organized cybercrime position. The other thing that I think you called out there is that and that we kind of went through was the that we're seeing that complete mesh between what is cybercrime, what is organized crime, and what is fraud, and that we can't really have be can't, we can't be detached from those. And even from my perspective, working with organizations, always from a cybersecurity perspective, obviously being CTO, I'm quite technically focused. But we never had that engagement with fraud teams, and something that we naturally, particularly we look sort of back 10 years ago, we wouldn't go anywhere near because fraud teams are very focused on things that aren't always cyber based. But now the that's only increasing as we go.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, so no, I think there's some real insights there. And I know we've got some other upcoming webinars on the horizon where we're going to dive down into some real detail in a few of the elements overall. So I think look, that's right. I think we're going to jump into a Q&A session. That obviously we've got a couple of questions in, and I'm going to take the opportunity to probably pick your brains a little bit further, Keegan. But just before we jump into that, I'll just call out that we do have some upcoming webinars and events. I'm sure you've seen on LinkedIn and from our webinar series that we have been running our security first conferences around the globe. And we are, for our H1 efforts, we are getting towards the end of that. So we have Paris coming up. So anybody in the Paris area, please sign up. We've got some great talks there on cybersecurity, on how do we redefine resilience, and how do we collaborate from an AI perspective. But also the great news is that we're not stopping there. I talked about it being H1, but we are adding more regions for H2, so in the autumn. So look forward to those as we'll be extending that reach out into North America, Europe, and other areas of Europe and beyond. And obviously, as I say, we've got a continued webinar series. So use the QR code there to access those. So we'll just, I don't know if you want to move on to the next slide, just to have our Q&A holding slide there, Keegan. Thank you very much. So we're going to jump down to the Q&A. And I think quite often this, I see I've got some more questions still coming in. I think this is probably one of the, not to talk down the things you've gone through, but I think one of some of the interesting bits as we get questions to dive down into. So just the first one here, in the last slide, you mentioned TTPs. What are the examples of them, and how can we more effectively use them?
So we're not just talking about like a table of IOCs, we need to actually be mapping their techniques. So for example, if the scam requires you to send a proof of payment to a specific bank account or to a specific email address and the payment to a specific bank account, these things need to be flagged. You need to be able to monitor them, flag them, and then go investigate and see whether or not this is legitimate behavior. And maybe just warn the customers, like, hey, are you sure you want to be sending money to this? This has been flagged for fraud in the past. So things like that. Yeah, it's we need to be mapping techniques rather than thinking just about IOCs. You know, we're not going to be like blocking all the domains and things because I mean they can rapidly spin up new domains. So we need to be mapping the techniques.
And which I think, and what that kind of brought to mind, as you mentioned it, I'm sort of curious about what you guys are seeing as the most popular campaigns and techniques that are being used. I mean, we're long, far away from the days of the Nigerian prince that just needs help getting all of his gold out the country if you can just send him $50,000. Well, I hope. Maybe you're going to tell me, actually, do you know what, there's plenty of Nigerian princes still out there. What are you seeing that's most common approaches and techniques that are being used?
So we've been seeing a lot of investment scams. So this is kind of loose for them because they get a lot of people to invest money and then they have a big sum of money at the end, but they also like to do like highly personalized scams. I think it's called pig butchering. So they would approach someone, build trust with them, build a conversation, and then at the end of the day they'd be asking them for money and then using that trust and exploiting them. I mean, people pay. And I mean, people have lost all of their life savings using that. So it's mostly investment scams, personalized scams, where they actually try and build a connection with you. And we've also seen a lot of loan scams. I mean, especially in like after the holiday periods when people are desperate, So it depends on the season as well. So yeah, they'll actually target just isolated individuals or people in financial stress, So they want easy targets, rather. They don't really care about the types of scams, just the quickest way to make the money.
Yeah,
They can put it
and
like that.
making them highly personable or personal, is that something that is becoming more easier, particularly when we kind of look at AI for being able to generate information on people. And actually,
Definitely.
sorry, the follow-up question, where is that kind of coming from? You mentioned kind of being able to get the ID and spent, going off 5 minutes later and coming back with your ID number. I guess, is it getting easier? And where are those common occurrences of that really cropping up? Because that's actually important outside of fraud for organizations, because there's obviously huge amounts of information there that can be used in phishing campaigns to compromise, even if it's a ransomware campaign.
So yeah, as I said, organizations get breached every day, and a lot of the times, this sensitive information, it just gets published. So it's not very hard to get it these days. Anyone with a computer, I guess you can Google, can probably get to it. And yeah, it's they just chuck all of this into AI, and then the AI writes personalized emails or WhatsApp messages or SMSs for their victims, and then they distribute it in a like in bulk. So yeah, very, very much personalized these days. And it's really hard to kind of spot it because they're getting really good at mimicking legitimate looking things. So you would get an email with a legitimate looking domain or a legitimate website looking. Well, recently I came across a Luno website, which was completely fake, but all the buttons worked. It looks like pretty nice, like exactly like the legitimate one, where you would usually in the past have buttons that didn't work or the scaling was a bit off, or so you could just see it looks a bit funny. But these days, everything just looks pretty legitimate.
Yeah, and with the AI-powered coding capabilities, you can see how easily and quickly you can spin up something like that. And being able to go to that level of depth to add that functionality, and that previously, just say you'd have had a probably just an image that looked like a button rather than anything that's actually clickable. So, John, we've got another question. What challenges do investigators face when mapping cybercrime hierarchies? So I suppose this goes up into that Council of Elders that that
Exactly.
I'm going to rename our C-suite to be.
Exactly. Yeah. So they use pseudonyms. This makes it pretty hard to actually map them because unless you have some inside insight, you won't be able to know. And if we look at the types of financial fraud that's going on, for the use of shell companies and the layers of abstraction between the entities perpetrating the crime and the entities benefiting from the crime, that's really hard to kind of identify. Because they really put layers and layers and layers of protection. So lots of shell companies, lots of pseudonyms, lots of like offshore bank accounts, and yeah, it's kind of hard these days to actually move it out.
Yeah, and do we get to the point of where we're identifying individuals that are orchestrating these? Is that as much as it's around identifying, pulling down the infrastructure supporting it, and making aware, what are the steps for actually getting to a point where we're reducing them from happening in the first place?
So sure, it is more difficult, you know. So it's normally someone on the inside that gets a bit of information, and that helps the investigations quite a bit. But yeah, as I said, the reduced physical risk with operating online is really great. Very little people get arrested, and the ones that do just make stupid mistakes, honestly.
So just another question here. I think we might have actually answered a little bit of this when we were talking about the AI just now. So apologies for whoever asked this question, and I've jumped ahead. How has automation changed the life cycle of a cybercrime campaign?
Yeah, so it's very iterative these days. So we take down one domain, they spin up another one, or they feel like this one impersonation is no longer getting the traction they want, so they just quickly impersonate someone else and then use their brand to kind of build trust and legitimacy. So yeah, it's very iterative, and it's very quick. They're very quick to kind of adapt these days, especially with AI things. It's almost instant. One day it's this thing, and next day it's another.
Yeah. But what about the other side of it? So I guess your side of the house, and how AI and automation, is that something that's coming into play to be able to expand those kind of investigation practices?
For sure. Anything that can make our investigative load a little bit lighter, we're very open to. So yeah, if we can like We have a couple of local AI training and we feed it information, and it's very good at like spotting things that we would normally miss. So it's good at spotting patterns and things we didn't even think about actually looking into. So it's been kind of really helpful with it.
Yeah, a real assistant. Just another question here on, and again, it's about targeting actually. What psychological profiling techniques do cyber criminals use to improve targeting?
Yeah, so that again goes to they're like easy targets. So they do research on people that look to be socially isolated or are in financially stressful positions. So they want vulnerable people that would make easy targets and quick bucks, you know. So it's very much targeted to vulnerable people these days.
Yeah, and yeah, there's, you know, if we link that to from a business perspective, and actually when we had our security first in Mauritius last week, and our guest speakers really talked through some of that psychological aspect of, you know, why people fall for it. And obviously you sort of talk about socially isolated, but it's also fatigue, you know, it's you know, the almost muscle memory to clicking and opening things, but also playing on some of our psychological shortcomings that everybody has, that's, you know, that we need to keep it all, you know, being able to bring urgency, authority,
Exactly.
and, you know, very linked to that, sort of those investment scams, and you know, really being able to, you know, really give a carrot to people that that, and actually there's a scam for everybody, you know, if it's you know, if you you know, if you have lots of money, then there's an investment scam, as you say, to try and make even more money. And if you don't, then there's a get rich quick scam. So, and although we're talking about fraud, and, you know, there's, I'm sure in the audience we've got a wider selection beyond just fraud, you know, the implications are the same from a harvesting credentials, harvesting information, being able to deploy malware all through these activities. And if we look at, you know, what's one of the number one ways that organizations are compromised now, and actually we had Lucy from Vectra that talked at some of our conferences, and one of her key points was that, you know, hackers don't, you know, hack into a business, an organization anymore. They simply log in because they're using the credentials to be able to target and gain access into those environments. So I think there's, you know, there's a lesson to be learned there, you know, beyond just fraud and targeting of end customers, but also end users. So just, we've got a few, Josh, we've got some questions still coming in here. So please feel free. We've got a bit of time if you have any other questions you'd like to test Keegan on. One question here is, how do organized cybercrime groups maintain operational security while coordinating across borders?
So, I mean, OPSEC is as important to them as it is to us, you know. So they definitely use encrypted communications. They would use platforms that don't really care about law enforcement requests, so things like Telegram. They also have compartmentalized roles. So no single person, except maybe for the leadership roles, know exactly what's going on in there. So they don't really know each other. They don't really know what's the bigger picture of everything. They just know they have a job and this is what they do. So if one of them gets caught, the information that they have is very limited and doesn't really lead to so many arrests.
Yeah, I mean, it's classic organized crime, just applied to a cyber world.
Exactly.
Brilliant. So, Joe, I've got another question coming here. So the question here is, what are the minimum cybersecurity protections every company should have in place today?
So I think the main things are awareness training. People need to know that it's not to click on links, not to trust anyone. If it's too good to be true, it probably is. And I mean, the biggest thing with these types of scams, well, with the biggest things with these types of compromises is the human factor. I mean, we can put in all the security fences that we can, but if a human falls for it, then they're actually redundant. So just training the user base, making sure everybody knows to be wary of everything. Don't click on links. If it's too good to be true, definitely stay away. Don't trust anyone. I mean, there's a lot of weird things going on these days, and a lot of people out there to just get your mind.
Yeah, no, it's spot on. We can talk about all of the fancy cybersecurity controls, but it does come back to a few main things, and that human firewall is definitely a top priority, alongside basic cyber hygiene. Look at if I look at our incident response team and their a lot of their engagements, they're responding to breaches where that cyber hygiene, whether it's from a human perspective, the identity protection, with identity being so key, that it isn't always in place, which then becomes a bit of a low-hanging fruit. And I'll very briefly just touch upon everyone's favorite topic at the moment, or it's slightly waning, less people are talking about Mythos. But what's the impact that we can expect from Mythos? Besides creating too many security bugs requests into the Linux organization that's upsetting poor Linus at the moment, it's going to be that deluge of vulnerabilities that are looking to be exploited at a huge rate. So, basic cyber hygiene is what's going to defend us from that. Joe, we've got quite a few more questions coming in. So, Keegan, I'm going to keep you for longer than you expected here. So, another question here is, and sorry, that isn't the call for stopping asking questions. Definitely keep going. A question here: with phishing playbooks becoming more sophisticated, how common are Microsoft Teams scams becoming in corporate environments, and how can companies best protect users against them?
Of course. I mean, it's always been a thing, and it's going to continue being a thing. It's just going to become more difficult to spot. In terms of the playbooks, it's going to just become more detailed, and I mean, it just makes it easier for anyone with zero technical or any experience at all to jump right into the operation and begin scamming people. So yeah, it's definitely just going to get worse from here on up, especially with all the AI things. It's going to be quicker, it's going to be more difficult to spot, and it's going to just come in, and it's going to be a lot to handle.
Yeah, and you called out in one of your slides going through actually those playbooks being effectively the experts in the that criminal world creating those playbooks that are enabling people, as you say, so that people the barrier to entry is so much smaller. And actually, we see that across all cybersecurity. You don't need to have that technical knowledge. I mean, you've got AI to back you up. I talk about it quite a lot, how a member of our finance team was able to put together a CRM application, that's as a proof of concept of what they're looking for. Very, very quickly, with absolutely zero technical knowledge whatsoever, just access to Claude code. So that barrier for entry is getting lower, particularly when there's tools that you can buy off the shelf to be able to orchestrate these attacks. I do think it's something that we'll see more and more. And I think there's particularly when it comes to Microsoft Teams, I need to think about actually how do we protect against that in terms of using controls to be able to control who's actually asking to join from a Teams perspective, because you can obviously just from an external perspective say, hey, we want to invite you to our Teams channel, that's then give that access. And the other thing is the use of deepfakes for Teams calls, because they can be extremely realistic. You showed those examples of those fraud tactics of a popular news person really putting their name behind this investment opportunity as being realistic, because you can see that person that you already know. Replicate that into a Teams call. We saw the a couple of years ago now, I think it was, that we saw the Arup breach that that's one out of the four people on a call, the person that was targeted was the only real person. And obviously that was all staged, or say staged, that was all pre-recorded information to have those conversations. But I think the step now, if you look at things like conversational AI, it's becoming, near real time. I mean, you can go to any tools now and, record enough of yourself in the right background for it to then allow you to be a complete avatar, in your voice, your look, answering questions. So I think, that is becoming more of a challenge. On that deepfake side, there are tools in the market, coming to market, to be able to identify when deepfakes are there that you can add into your team session. So I would say that that's probably a, if you're, and obviously that goes beyond just scams. That is getting into compromise an organization, looking at investing in those tools, or at least investigating the potential of using those so that your users can add in a an AI agent into the call to be able to monitor, particularly if you think it's, potentially malicious. So just a few more questions. We might actually follow up on some of the answers for these as we're kind of we're almost 45 minutes in. So one here is, to what extent are internal employees targeted for cybercrime? What do you suggest to combat this?
Well, I mean, as you said, cybercriminals don't just hack into things anymore. They just use the login credentials. So, the easiest way to get into it is to target the employees. Ask them, you can pay them, you can extort them, to get them to get their credentials, and then makes your job a lot easier as a criminal. So to defend against that, I mean, if you have a malicious insider, it's one of those things. That's something every business needs to be cautious about, because it does happen. I mean, I think last year somewhere there was a guy from the BBC who was approached by a kind of a big criminal group, and he said, "No, well, we can make you rich. Just give us your login credentials, and nobody will know it was you." And the guy eventually said no and reported it, and he actually wrote a news article about it. So it's going to happen, whether we like it or not, and it's going to increase as we go on.
Yeah, and I think the key phrase or term you used there was insider threat, and I think that against these types of campaigns and that targeting organizations. And I, as soon as I read the question out, I thought, actually, the thing that came to mind is paying employees for that, for your login credentials, or even just to go and detonate some malware. From a malware perspective, your controls there to secure yourself are your EDR. It's it's the your SIEM platform. It's your security operations around that, whether it's internal or MDR service externally. But I think there's that insider risk and being able to monitor behavior, and deviations from behavior is what's going to secure that. I mean, things like, even the most basic level, making sure that you have the ability to detect, improbable access so that, you're logging in from two locations very, very quickly. Actually, have you given your credentials away, or has your credentials already been compromised elsewhere? And obviously, you can put protections in place. And I suppose it depends. With obviously MFA gets bypassed, but with MFA, where you're having to ask to, is that you, enter the code. Really, I suppose an insider threat, a true insider threat, is going to be helping them over that hurdle. But there's still that that ability to look for that, and also when they're inside the network, so being able to look for that network behavior, peer group analysis, and things like that. So, what should we? That's really how we're going to combat that. And I think, the important term
So,
used there was insider threat.
but on that topic, I believe the next presentation, the application layer threat hunting, will go more into depth on this specific thing, where we will we investigate anomalies, like user anomalies, and then this kind of flags fraud, fraudulent operations, or fraudulent behavior, or just weird behavior that should be investigated a bit further.
Indeed. So I tell you what, there's quite a few more questions in. So I'm going to cherry pick one to ask you. And then what we'll do is for the rest of them, we'll follow up on email with some detailed answers on them. So just flick through here. And do you know what? There's one just here that the last one that's come in here is, what are your thoughts on the value of red teaming simulations in the context of defensive training and the evolving landscape you've discussed today? And any thoughts on how better to coordinate the two worlds, red and blue?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as I said, we can't operate in silos. So we need to be a purple team, you know. So I've run a few red team operations where we target the human aspect and the whole thing. We didn't even touch any cyber components, just talking to people, getting their access cards, things like that. So this is going to be very important in the coming few years, you know, teaching people not to fall for things like that. Teaching them to be wary about if someone approaches you and asking you for your access card, say no, you know. So that's going to be very, very important. And yeah, it'll show companies like where their weaknesses actually lie, you know, and it's going to be mostly within the human factor.
Yeah,
Obviously, there's
I'm a big advocate of red teaming exercises because they do, you know, and particularly if you're doing a red team exercise, it needs to be broad, not just phishing attacks or trying to externally compromise, but having that physical element in, as you say, trying to get access cards, trying to tailgate people into a building. We've seen cases of where our guys have just gone to the smoking area around the back, and someone's just held the door open for them because so they can go back to work. So it does need to be broad ranging, but I think it's hugely valuable because you're getting the actual view of your security posture, because it's not just, if you look at a pen test, it's just going to test the vulnerabilities on this system, but actually it's showing the vulnerabilities of your people, your systems, and also your processes to how you can identify and then respond to those as well. And then, we're sort of talking about the blue team. You're right, it does need to be a purple team engagement, really, because you need to rerun that and go through, well, actually, where was this missed? What do we need to do? And that will go to the human side. What better ways do we need to educate our users so they're not just turning a blind eye, and they're not just allowing people to walk into the premises and plug something in somewhere. And that value then goes further up because it is eye-opening. I mean, then obviously, if I was taking this on a path, you take it to tabletop exercises to involve, senior management in it, so they understand their role, what can happen, and it's not just to provide some scary news to unlock some budget so that you can spend some money on something, but it does truly help that appreciation because they've got a whole set of activities they need to do, they need to understand, and there's a question here about making it illegal to ransom to pay ransoms that we'll answer and get a view on, or maybe I'll end up covering it here. But there are legal restrictions in places. So there's a legal perspective, there's a brand perspective, and then also there's a cybersecurity incident response perspective. So there's actually quite a lot that needs to be chained together to get that view. I think it really does then show your security posture. Brilliant. Well,
Yeah,
do you
well,
know what? We're 50 minutes into this webinar, so I am going to close it there. We have got three more questions in that we will provide some follow-up answers on. So that just leaves me just to say thank you very much, Keegan, for joining us and sharing some of your insights, some of your knowledge and experience, which has given yourselves Redshift that view on how cybercrime's operating, how those scams are operating, and some insights into what we should be doing. And then lastly, just to say thank you to everybody that has joined and taken 50 minutes, valuable minutes out of your day to join us on this webinar. Thank you.
thanks, everyone.